Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. The life of a White House correspondent has changed dramatically in the last few years. From early morning tweets to alternative facts to outright vilification of the news media, President Donald Trump has upended the conventions of Washington. And that's presented new challenges for journalists whose job it is to make sense of it all. A panel of correspondents and columnists who have covered the White House recently gathered in Seattle to discuss just how much things have changed and what it takes now to get at the truth. Darlene Superville has been a White House reporter for the Associated Press since 2009. Before that, she supervised the AP's evening political desk for the 2000, 2004, and 2008 presidential campaigns. Ashley Parker is a White House reporter for the Washington Post. She was a member of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize in 2018 for its coverage of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Philip Rucker is the White House bureau chief for the Washington Post. He was also on the Post Pulitzer Prize winning team in 2018 and has covered the White House, Congress, and politics at the paper since 2005. John Fund is the national affairs columnist for National Review magazine and a contributor to FoxNews.com. He previously served as a columnist and a member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal. Adam Levine is founder and CEO of Words Matter Media. His career as a television producer and congressional staffer includes 2 years as assistant White House press secretary to President George W. Bush. He moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Washington Policy Center. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
There we are. Thank you very much. As they noted, my name is Adam Levine, and for those of you who are expecting the guy from The Voice, I apologize in advance. I won't say that the ambiguity was intentional by our host, but when you're up against Macklemore and the Kentucky Derby, they've got to do something. As they know, we're going to all introduce ourselves. I founded Words Matter Media. I was very fortunate in my life. I started off working for the late, great Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York. And the senator would be thrilled to know that he has been quoted on Twitter more in the last 4 years, saying everybody is entitled to their own opinion, not their own facts, more than he was in his 40 years in public life. That also led to another of my friends and mentors, the late, great Tim Russert, which is where Words Matter comes from. When I went into government, I would prepare government officials for Tim's show. At the end of that prep, I would always do what I called Columbo, and I'd say, oh, by the way, Dr. Rice, if at any time during this interview, Tim Russert leans across the table and says, words matter, concede the point and move on. Because if you don't, he's going to spend whatever time is left beating you up. And that advice was always listened to. I will go down our panel. Darlene?
Hi. Thanks. It's great to see so many people in the audience today. I wanted to thank the Crosscut Festival folks for having the panel and having me be a part of it. I cover the White House for the Associated Press, and I've been at the White House since President Obama was in office. So I've been there for almost 10 years now.
I'm Ashley Parker. I work for the Washington Post covering the White House. I joined the Post basically when Trump became president, and before that I had worked for the New York Times. I covered Mitt Romney's campaign. My first job there was Maureen Dowd's research assistant. I covered the Romney campaign. That's where Phil Rucker and I became sort of frenemies. And then in 2016...
We're friends.
Yeah, I mean, now. And in 2016, for The Times, I covered Jeb Bush, and then when poor sweet sad Jeb Bush dropped out, I moved to Trump. So I've been with him at both The Times and now The Post.
Yeah, I'm Phil Rucker. I have been at The Washington Post since college. I started there as an intern, and have been covering politics for about 10 years, including the Romney campaign and Congress. And I spent some time at the Obama White House, and then, of course, the 2016 campaign, Trump coming down the escalator, and the rest is history. So I cover the White House, the Trump White House, and in addition to my work at the Post, Ashley and I both are analysts for MSNBC, so you may see us there too.
John Fund, I'm originally from San Francisco. I've had the dubious distinction of spending much of my career in New York. I've actually known and covered Donald Trump for over 30 years, and I've seen almost every phase of that. We can find out if there are any insights from that. I worked at the Wall Street Journal until 2013, and now I'm at National Review, and I'm one of those talking heads. And I was in that first category of pundits that MSNBC hired back in 1996. So I think I've rotated through all three of the cable networks.
Thank you very much. I wanted to start today and talk to each of our panelists about something they've written about this administration and put it through that context. And Ashley, I wanted to start with you because I thought we'd start with a little nostalgia today. Okay. Exactly 1 year ago today, there was an article in your paper that authored by yourself, Mr. Rucker, and another one of your colleagues, and it was called under the headline of, "As a willing warrior for Trump, Sarah Sanders struggles to maintain credibility." Exactly 1 year ago today. A couple of things jumped out when I read that article. One, at that point in the administration and his presidency, Donald Trump had only, according to your Washington Post fact checker, racked up 3,000 false or misstatements. And we are now at 10 for those of you keeping score at home.
That's 10,000.
10,000, I'm sorry. 10,000. So we're picking up a rate. The other thing is that you described us a different Sarah Sanders than we see. You described an offstage Sarah Sanders, one that joked about her being out of the loop as to the next firing or tweet, one who would stay at the MSNBC party at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and greet reporters till well after midnight. What's changed?
I would actually sort of stand by that description of Sarah Sanders. I mean, I found, and I think a lot of journalists who cover her found that she does sort of have these two different, I don't want to say faces, like two different versions of her. There's the Sarah Sanders who is standing up there at the podium in her job, and people can disagree and they do so vociferously, but her job is to parrot the administration's line. And then there's the Sarah Sanders behind the scenes who with journalists is quite respectful, quite professional, and always, at least in my experiences, and I think this is true of Phil, endeavors to always tell the truth. And I have to say, in a White House where Phil and I, when we're working on stories with our team, we sort of think of sources in the president's orbit having like different levels depending on who it's coming from. I never covered another White House, but my sense was in the Obama White House or in the Bush White House, if, say, Karl Rove or David Axelrod told you something, it was just true, right? And now we sort of think of sources as, oh, you know, I heard a tip from this person who's right 50% of the time, or I heard a tip from this person who lies 90% of the time, but remember that one time when we chased it down and they were correct, and we think of some sources like Wikipedia. It's a really good jumping off point, but you would...
Is 15% high?
But you would... I mean, they vary, right? But you would never cite them in a term paper like the Wikipedia source. But it's a, you know, it's a pretty good jumping off point. So anyhow, within that world, I think Sarah's value that I appreciate is, again, you can go to her and she may not leak to you and she may not tell you everything you want to know, but she will say, you know, this is right, this is right. You're right that there was a fight inside the Oval Office, but you're missing the context. You know, everyone was laughing 2 minutes later. And this is 100% wrong, and I don't know where you're getting it from. So I personally don't know that that much has changed.
Phil, since you were also on our, you know, your take on how post-Mueller report, post other things, we had Joe Lockhart, my colleague, on our podcast, a former press secretary himself, didn't think that she could go back into the room with any real credibility. I don't know if he's right on that, but what's your sense, a year exactly to the day after a story like that?
So a year later, I agree with the things that Ashley said, and I'll just add another dimension to the Sarah Sanders character, which is she's made a pretty profound change in the way the White House interacts with the public, which is there are no longer White House briefings. There used to be these briefings every single day. This is why Sean Spicer had so much trouble keeping the job, because he performed poorly in the briefings. But Sarah, ever since last summer, has really scaled back the number of briefings, and now it's been, I think, 40-some-odd days since the last time she has done that. So to the public, you don't have this accountability feature. Like, the White House press briefing is not just a forum for us to ask questions or for the press secretary to spar with reporters, but it's a way for the American people to hold the officials in government accountable. The press secretary is the face of the federal government and is out there every day, supposed to be providing information to the American people, answering questions, being challenged about decisions that are being made in the government, and that just doesn't take place anymore. You know, Sarah Sanders functions as a press secretary behind the scenes and certainly engages with us on stories and will help clarify things the way Ashley just explained, but that public accountability component is gone.
And that's, I think that's a great point. And Darlene, when I was at the White House for President Bush 43, the Associated Press, the briefing was important. I think you guys have something like 263 news bureaus in 106 countries around the world.
We have bureaus. Is this working? We have bureaus in all 50 states, and there was like 65 to 70 bureaus in countries around the world. So the Associated Press is literally everywhere.
So you have an inexhaustible need for up-to-date news. And as Phil pointed out, I did the research. I remember in 2002, my first year in the White House, Ari, because of the president's travel schedule in a election year, a couple of other things, we were touching that 150 briefings a year number. I think, as you noted, Phil, last year there were 64, and I think 80% of those were in the first half of the year.
And this year there are probably not even 10. It's probably been two or three.
I could only count two, unless you count the one, Darlene, that you wrote about, where on Bring Your Children to Work Day, Sarah Sanders briefed the children of the White House Press Corps, and I kid you not the White House Press Corps. And you wrote about that. How much does, as Phil says, not having that briefing hurt your ability to provide that information to those millions of people who read your stories?
Well, as Phil said, there is that accountability function that is lost. Everyone here in the audience, you no longer get to see a spokesperson for the White House. And this issue is not only, is not limited to the White House. The Pentagon has also gone for almost a year, maybe more, without anyone over there briefing the Pentagon Press Corps. And it's pretty much the same situation at the State Department. So all of you in the audience, you no longer get to see anyone from the White House, from the Pentagon, from the State Department, any of your government officials standing up and defending their policies, explaining what they're doing, why they're doing it, how it's going to affect you, that sort of thing. It's not only for us, it's for you as well. And as Phil said, that's lost. She did come back into the briefing room. I'm trying to remember, all the days kind of run together now. I think it was last week for Take Your Sons and Daughters to Work Day, and it was 1 week after the Mueller report came out, and it was revealed that she had said something months earlier that turned out not to be true, and she had to admit that to the investigators, that her comments were based on pretty much nothing. And so she came in and did the briefing for the children, and it's a nice thing for the White House to do, to allow reporters and staffers to bring their kids in to see the White House, interact with the president, the first lady, the vice president, Secret Service, you know, have a day at the White House. But a lot of reporters in the room that day were a little ticked off that she did that, and that it has been more than a month since we have been able to question her in an open forum. And the job of press secretary is more than just to get up every day and stand in the briefing room and do a briefing. And she does answer emails, she does take phone calls, she does meet with reporters behind the scenes. There is a behind the scenes component to being the press secretary, but there is also the briefing aspect that is important and that is now lost. And it's my understanding that one of the reasons, and probably the reason that she really doesn't do them anymore, is because the president doesn't want her to do them. You'll notice that when he leaves the White House, before he gets on the helicopter, in the Oval Office yesterday, he's taking questions from reporters several times a day. And this goes back to the president and his feeling that he's his own best spokesperson, and he can do it better than anybody.
Switching gears a little bit, John Fung, as a columnist, you have a little bit of a different charge than our other three panelists. And you write for, obviously, the National Review is one of the places where you write, and that was founded, of course, in 1955 by someone I refer to as the patron saint of American conservatism, William F. Buckley, Jr. And one of Mr. Buckley's legacies was his great pride in kicking what he called the kooks, extremists, bigots, racists, and anti-Semites out of the GOP. So, and again, I've read what you've written, and you offer great caution to Republicans. How is that, how is covering this White House with that charge, with the sort of tradition of Buckley and conservatism, not necessarily Republicanism, but conservatism, how has that changed under Donald Trump, somebody you've known for 30 years?
Challenging. The first magazine in America to ever run a cover that said Never Trump was National Review. That was in December of 2015, early on. I think the way that a magazine of opinion covers Donald Trump is that you cover two things. You cover the person, his actions, and you also recognize that the government is bigger than one person. There's lots of people making news in the Cabinet Department. Sometimes I think the media is so fixated on Trump and the White House, they ignore what goes on in the agencies. And there's Trump policies. And those are not disassociated from Donald Trump, but they are a separate point of discussion. What are the policies? Are they wise? Are they good? Are they having interesting results? Picking up on what you said about Donald Trump thinking he's his own best press secretary, I recall in the late 1980s, Donald Trump, by the way, the probably the least known personal item about Donald Trump is there is no limit to how cheap he is. I mean, there are tales of him refusing to pay bills that are $3 just because he can and he doesn't want to pay $3. So in the 1980s, people would suddenly, reporters all over New York would get calls from his press guy, John Miller. And John Miller was extremely aggressive in pushing Donald Trump into the broadcast and print outlets. And finally, he was so aggressive and so outrageous and said would make up such incredible stories about what Donald Trump was up to. One reporter famously said, Mr. Trump really doesn't sound like he would do that. Are you sure this is coming from Donald Trump? And John Miller said, well, I'm intimately knowledgeable about Donald Trump's opinions. Anyway, we eventually figured out at an inner circle dinner of journalists that there really was no John Miller, that Donald Trump was masquerading as his own press secretary. So I think there's a long tradition here where Donald Trump is A, cheap, and B, willing to go to any lengths to get coverage, and C, willing to pretend he's anything to do so.
Absolutely. And speaking of long traditions, and I will direct this to Mr. Rucker to start, which is presidents don't traditionally love the White House press corps and love less often what they write. And I will cite the example, the famous example of LBJ saying that he was able to get up and walk from behind his desk across the Potomac River on top of the water to the Pentagon. The headline in your newspaper the next day would be, President Can't Swim. But this is a whole different level, obviously, of the adversarial relationship that since the dawn of the Republic. How is it, and I don't want to, my previous boss, President Bush 43, hated to be put on the couch, so I will try not to do that too much, but how is it to do what is, in even the best of circumstances, an incredibly hard job, when every single day, the person you're covering viciously attacks you as an enemy of the people? And I mean that seriously.
Yeah, so the attacks indeed are vicious and are new, and it's important. I would posit that there's another side to the story too, which is that as much as Trump complains about the press and attacks the press and undermines the press and says he hates the press, we are his oxygen. Like, we sustain him. He would go mad if he were not on the front page of the Washington Post the next morning. You know, this is what he lives for. He wants to be the center of it all. He loves the fact that for the last 2+ years, the world has been paying attention to him every hour of every day. It's one of the reasons he tweets so often about all sorts of issues that, you know, may not fall under the purview of a commander-in-chief and president of the United States, but, you know, he wants to get into the discussion. He wants to be the center of it. So to that degree, he needs us, and to that extent, he likes us. I mean, he will call us enemy of the people and attack us, and then in private, try to charm us and be charismatic and cajole us. And I remember I did a story, I think Ashley worked with me on a story at the day of the Kavanaugh hearing when Brett Kavanaugh got voted in to become a Supreme Court justice last fall. And we did a whole story. It was like a TikTok narrative account of how the Trump White House got him to the Supreme Court and overcame all of these obstacles. And the next morning, it was a Saturday, and I was driving to Bed Bath & Beyond to return an item that I didn't need anymore. And I got a call, and it was from the White House, and the operator just said, "Can you please hold for the president?" And I pulled into the parking lot and put the car in park, and sure enough, it was Donald Trump calling to congratulate me on what a wonderful story, because it was like a victory for him that this, you know, deeply compromised judicial nominee made it through the Republican-controlled Senate. So that's just an example. He can attack us all the time and call us the enemy of the people, but he loves us, he needs us, and he wants us on his side, and he tries to charm us.
Yeah, and Ashley, I would ask you to put that through also the lens, if you'd like, of how this president has been known to treat women, female reporters, people of color. I think just yesterday, he referred to Kristen Welker from NBC as rude. Now, if anybody has ever met Kristen Welker, there are puppies that are ruder than Kristen Welker. She's an incredibly nice woman. I don't think she could be rude if she tried. How is that dynamic different in you? And then same question to you, Darlene.
So I'll take part of that. And one thing that's worth mentioning is, and again, this was actually a lot worse for TV correspondents on the campaign trail who are very visible and very recognizable, but he would attack, you may recall, you know, little Katie Turr, and attack these people by name. And Phil was actually at, I had this sort of surreal experience of watching Donald Trump attack me, and I'll just kind of take you through it. This was a rally in San Diego. It was a huge rally. The press at Donald Trump rallies were always sort of in a pen, basically. And to be clear, the press is always in a pen. We're never not in a pen. It doesn't matter who the candidate is. Normally, you're sort of in bike racks in a pen near the back of the rally, but with Trump, he would sort of put in, Trump's rallies are so much larger than any other candidates, but so he would put you in a pen in the middle of the rally, and at some point, the crowd came to expect that just as at some point he would say that we were going to build the wall, and, you know, he would say, what are we going to do in the crowd? And cheer like, build the wall, and, you know, who's going to pay for it? Mexico. There would be a moment where he would turn to the media who is surrounded by his supporters and just say, like, they're disgusting, they're scum, they're despicable. Do you even have those cameras on? And, you know, everyone would chant, like, CNN sucks, CNN sucks. And it's sort of like at a rock show, you know, that, like, Bon Jovi will do an encore of Living on a Prayer, right? It was just part of the Trump show. And so I was sitting there at a rally. This was in San Diego. It was a huge rally. It was actually the rally where he attacked Judge Curiel for the first time. I was at the New York Times, and Phil was sitting next to me from at the Post, and we had just posted a story that he didn't like, myself and Maggie Haberman, and Trump starts talking about it. There's the story that the New York Times just posted. It's by a woman named Parker and a woman named Haberman, and, you know, they're the worst and they're disgusting, and, like, they're not here today, are they? Like, is the woman named Parker here? Like, I'm right there, right? I'm at the front of the pen in the middle of this rally, but I'm not a TV person. I go on MSNBC, but I'm not a TV person. I'm a print reporter. So nobody really, unless you're an avid viewer of MSNBC, knows what I look like. So the whole crowd is like, boo, hiss, like, Parker. And I just, like, kept on typing and, like, looked around for that horrible Parker, right? Like, it's like, is she here? Like, I hope not. But you know, it felt very uncomfortable, I have to say, and I can kind of joke about it because truly no one knew who I was. And Phil was there, but there's like a world in which as a young woman or a woman, any sort of human covering Trump, that it could be very uncomfortable. And a lot of our friends who are TV correspondents ended up, their networks ended up providing private security for them to walk them, you know, to and from rallies late at night in parking lots. And that is, like, incredibly uncomfortable, incredibly dangerous, and a really tough way to live.
Katie Turr has told a story where she was at a rally and the environment got so heated that night that the Secret Service, which normally doesn't do anything for journalists, they actually escorted her to her car because of a lot of the things the president was saying about her at that rally and riling up the audience.
And John Fund, I know you don't, again, cover on a daily basis, but I was going through some of your columns, and you wrote one last June that I wanted to ask you about, where you called Trump a bulldozer. And you were giving a caution to Republicans, to other Republicans, to throwing their loyalty. And here's what you said. You said, if they can summon the courage, Republicans in Congress still have a higher responsibility than demonstrating loyalty to Trump. It's to their constitutional oath, it's to their reality-based arguments, and it's to conservative principles. That can't go over well with some of the people who read and watch you. Do you get negative reaction when you state something like that?
You betcha. On the other hand, again, I comment both on Donald Trump and I also comment on his policies, many of which I think I agree with and have had salutary results. All you have to do is look at some of the recent economic numbers, for example. See, I knew that would come. You're responding exactly as I anticipated. Boy, tough crowd. So the answer is yes. I do think, though, that it's easy and accurate and true to talk about Trump's bad behavior and his foibles. But as the media, we should understand that Trump is having the time of his life because he's untethered by traditional moral standards. And he loves the fact that he lives rent-free in the media's minds. And he loves the fact that no matter what he does, he gets attention. And no matter what he does, he gets a Pavlovian response from the media.
If you look at his Twitter, I think the media lives rent-free in his mind, too.
I didn't say it wasn't mutual. Having said that, I think that this panel is about covering Donald Trump.
Right.
I think we also need to understand that the outside public that we all work for is looking at Washington, D.C., and far too many of them are saying a pox on both your houses. If you look at the polls for media credibility and belief in the media's honesty and integrity, they have fallen since Donald Trump's election. The Morning Consult poll, which is borne out by other polls, 56% of people think Trump is dividing the country. 64% of the American people think the media is dividing the country. Confidence in the media is down to 33%. Donald Trump's approval rating hovers around 40%. We are paying a price, we all are paying a price for this chaos, this confusion, and this unusual time. And I think that it's incumbent upon us not just to criticize what Donald Trump, that's very easy to do. It's also understand that some of the mistakes that have been made in the coverage, perhaps in overheated coverage, and I point to the Mueller report and the two-year saga that that resulted in, that has also damaged the credibility of the media as well as Donald Trump. We're all going down together as confidence in institutions collapses. And by the way, the latest polls show that Democrats just saw a double-digit drop in their confidence in the media. So this is not something that is just limited to Trump voters.
I think this is a good time to take an audience question. Tamara, has the White, and I'll direct this to you, Darlene, has the White House press corps ever actively discussed walking out of a briefing in protest? What would it take for something like that to happen, if ever?
That's an interesting question. I think the answer is no. I don't think we've ever sort of gotten together as a group and talked about walking out of a briefing or a Sarah Sanders briefing or any other briefing. I know there's been outside commentary that, oh, we should do this, but I think it would be a slippery slope to do something like that, because if you walk out of a briefing, then that says to the White House, well, we don't want a briefing, when in fact we really do want briefings. So, no.
Ashley, in terms of, you know, your newspaper gets picked on by name often. Is there a sense of we need to do more as a White House Correspondents Association? Is there, or is this, or are we just in a different place?
Well, I think part of a way to answer this is part of the brilliance of Trump is that he sort of intuitively understands that if you go after the, as John was saying, media's approval ratings and trust is stunningly low. And so if you go after reporters, not all reporters, but some reporters will sort of fight back and make it, like in the briefing room especially, like a shouting match between them and the president or them and Sarah Sanders. And I think whenever the story is about us, we're losing. And that's not to say that you can't challenge the president or an administration official or press secretary with tough pointed questions and tough pointed follow-ups. You absolutely should. But when we get in a back and forth, like, you're fake news, no, we're not fake news, no, you're fake news, like, we are just losing. And so I think to the extent possible, sorry, I have a cold, but again, I think to the extent possible when he's, whatever, calling us, I believe it's the Amazon, Washington Post, or the failing New York Times, or whatever it is, like, I think the most important thing we can do is just to have clear, clean, fair, accurate journalism and not give him any excuse to attack us. And one final thing is there's something very surreal of having, it's probably happened to all of us up here, where you write a story and the president, you know, tweets out or in a press conference says that that's a fake story, that's false news. I mean, that is, he's still, at the end of the day, he's the president of the United States, and it's very surreal to have your reporting and your journalism called out by the president of the United States. What we know now is that it often means that your story is spot on. It will be revealed in several days that exactly what you wrote is exactly what happened. And he'll even admit it in a tweet, you know, 48 hours later. But it just means that you are accurate and he doesn't like it. But again, the best insulation is not, like, we're not the Amazon. It is just to do fair, accurate, objective stories and not give anyone any ammunition to take you down.
Sure. Phil, as a, you know, we talk about this lack of briefings. We talk about a White House that, I mean, one of the hallmarks of Bush 43 White House was Karen Hughes' famous message, discipline. This seems to be the opposite of that. Does that make it easier or harder when you call all those other sources to cover this White House? You've you know, been around since the Bush White House, the Post. You've obviously covered President Obama and this White House. Do a compare and contrast, which this style of communication, is it, does it make it more difficult or is it more fertile ground?
Yeah, a lack of message discipline in a White House is a reporter's dream scenario. You know, for society, it may not be a great thing because it creates confusion and it's unclear what exactly is happening. But for reporters, covering the Trump White House has been the most sort of fruitful beat because there are so many aides and officials inside the government who you have access to and who will tell you interesting, colorful things. And especially in the early months of the White House, who would go to the press, would like call up Ashley and Darlene and me and complain about things that were happening behind the scenes or rat out their colleagues for doing something wrong. Or, you know, as a reader, you see all this chaos, but as a journalist, we have so much more visibility into what's happening behind the scenes, into how decisions are being made, into what the president is saying behind closed doors, and which advisors have his ear, and understanding the origins of some of these really controversial policies. And I would argue that that's actually important for society and for the functioning of our country, for the journalists to be able to find that out. And because there's no message discipline in the Trump White House, we're able to find out so much more than we would otherwise.
And John, in our White House, one of my jobs was to reach out to people like you who wrote for opinion publications that didn't necessarily disagree with us all the time. Now for me, that cost a six-figure legal bill when one of your colleagues decided to print the name of a CIA operative in the Washington Post. But my question is, does this White House have the same outreach to columnists and to others in a systematic and organized way, or is it just who you know and on what topic?
Well, I think they have more of a flyover country strategy. If you're a conservative talk radio host in Des Moines, Iowa, you probably have already been to the White House, and you've probably already, you know, shared ice cream with Donald Trump. The opinion journals of the conservative movement, our relationship has been rocky. You know, we are interested in ideas. Donald Trump is interested in his own ideas. And so I'll say the communication has been minimal. Mike, you know, Donald Trump, you know, give him credit for this. He doesn't He can attack you and praise you within a few minutes. If you don't like what he's doing, wait 5 minutes. If you like what he's doing, wait 5 minutes. I remember once in New York, there were only 3 days that elapsed between a time when he had two words for me and they were not happy birthday, and a time when he invited me to, you know, fly down to Atlantic City in his corporate jet, which I had to decline, of course. So it's the carrot and the stick, and there's almost no period of time between them sometimes.
Darlene, I think that you and I, when we were talking before this session, I mentioned that, again, in Bush 43 world, every time before an Ari Fleischer briefing, Ron Fournier, who was covering the White House for the AP then, would come up to Ari's office and hand him a note. And on that note was what question he was going to ask. And that wasn't to give Ari a heads up on the question. It was so that Ari couldn't go back and say, well, let me find out and go back to you. And Ron came up with a very serious request to make sure he had that question answered. And what we knew was that if Ari tried to dodge, he would have convinced John King for Red Sox tickets or something to follow up, and then Campbell and David Gregory would always like a good fight with Ari. So, and I ask this because our question from Jamie is, do you think there should be more solidarity among reporters at the White House to push all these tough questions?
Yes, there can always be more solidarity, and there have been a few instances of solidarity among reporters in the briefing room. There was an episode where Sean Spicer was still the press secretary, and he wanted to do a briefing in his office. I can't remember what he wanted to talk about, whether it was just sort of a general briefing or on a specific issue, but only certain outlets were invited to that, and I think the New York Times was among those that were not invited. Some other ones were invited, and what ended up happening was that the head of the AP office at the White House at the time, who is now the bureau chief in Washington, Julie Pace, decided that we were not going to participate in that briefing if it wasn't open to the entire press corps. She left, and then some of the other outlets followed her, and they marched out of Spicer's office. And I think the briefing didn't happen. Does anyone remember? I think that's the way it was left. And there have been other instances, too, in some of the briefings that Sarah has done, where one reporter will ask a question, and she will not answer it completely or at all. And when she calls on the next reporter or the reporter after that, they will say, well, following up on so-and-so's question, can you please, and they sort of repeat the question and pretty much back up the reporter who didn't get an answer the first time. So I think President Trump has kind of helped us in some ways band together and work together more and kind of realize that we are all in this together to some degree more than we have in the past.
Ashley, just for 1 minute, in terms of the, we mentioned that the number of briefings has gone down, but obviously the news generated, and like you said, this is your first White House, but you've been a journalist for a long time. Talk a little bit about the volume, just the crush and volume of news and information from this, the pace of the job, both on a professional level and on a personal level.
So I think the best way to describe this, and Phil and I, this has changed a little bit, but at the Washington Post, we started the White House with two different rotations. There's six of us on the White House team. That's a big White House team, but every other White House team in the business is sort of just as large, and it often feels like if someone is traveling or sick or out for a day, we're wildly understaffed. But we have these two rotations. One is called duty, and that is what you would find in any traditional White House. It's the person who goes to the briefing. When there were briefings, it's the person who, if Trump goes to Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster, goes there for the weekend, it's the person who travels with Trump when he, you know, holds a rally on a Wednesday night. That's the duty reporter. That exists in every other White House. We had another position, and it has sort of fallen a bit by the wayside because we now have a breaking news team, but it was called Hot Seat, and everyone hated it. It was everyone's least favorite rotation, and when you were Hot Seat, you were basically responsible for sort of the fire hose of news that was the Trump presidency. And so just to give you a sense, when I was Hot Seat, I would set my, and I'm not, I mean, now I have a 6-month-old, but before I was not a morning person. And so when I was Hot Seat, I would set my alarm on my phone for 6 a.m., 6:15, 6:30, 6:45, and 7 a.m. And my alarm would go off, and I would like like roll over, check my phone to see if Donald Trump had tweeted. And if he hadn't, I would hit snooze and I would go back to sleep. And sometime like around 6:37, there would normally be a tweet from the President of the United States. It would normally be quite newsy. And I would pull my laptop into my bed and just begin filing. And that was sort of your day. And my understanding is that's not how it worked under previous administrations.
Let's go to another audience question. This one is from Tim and directed to Mr. Fund. John, how, as a conservative member of the press, do you view Fox News? I believe you write for their website here and there.
And I also appear often on them. Yes. Look, I want to make a blanket statement about all cable news, because I've worked at all three cable news networks, all three. My goal in life, having observed the operations of all cable news networks, is to be on television more than I watch it. If you actually go spend time in the sausage factory, you don't eat sausage much. I think if the American people knew, and this, I'm not trying to make an ageist comment here, if the American people knew how many decisions about the news they consume were made by 23-year-old junior producers, they would be a little skeptical. So my personal view is, as long as you have the internet, and as long as it's free, and as long as it's you can weed out the crazy stuff, spend a lot more time on the internet getting your news. Do not watch cable television unless you just want to be entertained. Do not pretend that it is a news gathering and a reporting source of great value. Now, I say that it pays some of my bills, so I'm not going to go into great detail about that, but that what I just said applies to all of the cable news networks.
Phil, this question is for you from Sarah. If the press is Trump's oxygen, why don't you use that power to suffocate him?
That's not our job. I mean, I'll just leave it at that. There are elections in our country, and that's why he's the president of the United States, and there's another election in 2020.
Or another impeachment.
And we're journalists, and we're chronicling this, we're covering this, we're asking questions, we're holding whoever is elected president accountable for the decisions that they make on behalf of the public, but we're not assassins.
I think that's right. Let's see what we have here. Darlene, this is from Anonymous, so I will. But how do you cover, in terms of fact-checking, obviously, the Washington Post, you guys have an extensive, how do you cover serious policy conversations when we noted the Washington Post has a rate of 10,000 false or misleading statements in the 800-plus days?
Well, we have at AP, and a lot of other news organizations have now also have adopted the same model. We have a fact check team. And we have a few people who every time the president gives a speech, he gave a speech last week or maybe 2 weeks ago to the NRA. We had a couple of reporters sitting there listening intently and just trying to listen for things that he said that may have sounded too good to be true, or that we knew to be false, that we knew he was stating wrongly, and then we sort of, do a separate story that points out he said this, but here is what the facts show, what the facts are. And also in daily stories that we write, we try to always include some sort of context to explain, again, while he may have said this, here is what the truth is, or here is what the facts show. And a lot of news organizations are doing that now. And in terms of straight up policy, a lot of the beat reporters are also responsible for doing that same kind of thing. The president announced the other day new rules for healthcare providers and teachers to not perform certain things, that do certain things that would violate their conscience or their religion. And so we have a reporter who covers the Health and Human Services Department, and he wrote that story with the proper context and background and everything that it is necessary to help readers understand what that's all about, why the president is doing this, and to provide the full picture of the story. So there's a lot more fact checking that's going on. with this president than I think in the past, and I think it's something that will outlive this president as well.
Ashley, you mentioned before, and Mr. Rucker mentioned, that the undisciplined, constantly fighting Trump White House is just a dream for reporters. How do you make sure you don't get weaponized in the Corey Lewandowski versus John Kelly fight and used in that way?
I mean, again, it sort of comes down to, Phil touched on this, but our goal and our job is to tell the truth, right? To present the news and what is going on in the White House as accurate as accurately as possible, as we best understand it. And so there's a line in a lot of Washington Post stories. Some other outlets, including the AP, are now also, I think, using it. We like it because we know people make fun of us, but there's often a line in Post stories that says, you know, this scene inside the West Wing is the result of 37 interviews with Republican lawmakers, White House advisors, senior officials, friends of the president, etc. There's a number of reasons we do that. One is to sort of tell the this is not the main reason, but it just makes the writing a lot more seamless because you kind of get that out of the way and you don't have to then be clunky at the end of every paragraph. But it's twofold. One is, it is really truly to tell the reader that this isn't just the disgruntled rumblings of Anthony Scaramucci, who was fired, or Corey Lewandowski. And the truth is, we talk to that many people because that is the only way we can understand the truth. And, you know, it's not necessarily, it is important for us to understand people's motivations of why they are telling us stuff, because it helps us understand, you know, are they lying because they're trying to knife a colleague, or are they disgruntled? But sometimes a disgruntled person is still accurate. They were still in the meeting. And so when we talk to those 27 people and we sort of balance, you know, were they a firsthand source? What is their motivation? How reliable are they normally? And we sort of put all of those pieces together. It is sort of through that kaleidoscope of whatever, 15 people or 27 people, that we can sort of say, like, okay, we weren't in the Oval Office that day, but we truly believe we understand what happened in the Oval Office because someone told us something, and then we checked it with three other people who were also in the Oval Office and kind of balance it out. And that is sort of how we get that portrait.
I think that is a good place to end. Thank you very much. Thank you for what you do every day, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle University. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.